Apparently, sort of etching said that.
We're continuing Parashat Vayigash. So Yosef reveals himself to the brothers, and he begs them not to fight on their way home. He gets special approval from Pharaoh to send out wagons with calves to bring Yaakov back to Egypt. Ordinarily in Egypt, they would not allow the export of calves because the Egyptians prided themselves in their calves. And so any calf that you wanted to take out of Egypt, they would remove the womb surgically to ensure that you could not compete with their calves, that you could not have more calves of the Egyptian breed outside Egypt. And Yosef can send calves outside. He has special approval from Pharaoh, and he sends the brothers back with gifts, and he begs them not to fight one another. Don't start discussing whose fault what is. Things are good. Let's move on with life. Now, there's truth to that. There's greatness in Yosef's ability to overlook the past or look at the past in a positive way. Yet there's also an importance to saying, I'm sorry. It is important sometimes to look back and say, you know, I was wrong. I want to apologize, and I want your forgiveness. And that never happens. And so this stain of the sale of Yosef will remain with us, and that's why we have the story of the 10 martyrs, that we are taught that this stain and this weight of this transgression remained with the Jewish people. We weren't done with it, even though Yosef and his brothers made up. And so the brothers go back to the land of Israel. They send Serach to prepare Yaakov that Yosef is still alive, and Yaakov doesn't believe them. So they say Yosef's alive, and he doesn't believe them. And they say, no, he's the leader of Egypt, and he doesn't believe them. And then they start telling me, don't understand. He said, you should come, I'll take good care of you. And then look, Shimon's back, and Binyamin's back, and everyone's okay. And he's like, okay, that doesn't prove that Yosef's alive. He spent 20 years mourning Yosef's death, and now they walk in one day and say he's alive. And then he looks out, they take him outside, and he sees all the wagons that Yosef sent. And that Yosef has sent him an escort to bring him back. And they tell him, Yosef asked to tell you that he still remembers the last thing you taught him. And the last thing you taught him is how you accompany a person when he leaves you, as you accompanied him that last day that he left you. And Yaakov thinks back. How many times did Yaakov probably think about that last conversation? How many times did Yaakov Avinu ask himself, you know, the last thing I told Yosef was about a person that leaves the city and gets murdered. And then my poor Yosef, look what happened to him. He left me and got murdered. Yaakov Avinu, it's easy to imagine that his mind was stuck to that conversation for the rest of his life. And now Yosef says, Dad, I remember what you taught me, and I remember the last thing you taught me. I remember you taught me how you accompany a person. And so Yaakov has to face reality. Yosef's alive. No one else knows that last conversation Yaakov had with Yosef. And then he sees that Yosef sends him the calves to take him down to Mitzrayim. And Yosef says, I've lived up to what you taught me. I'm sending you accompaniment. I want to be with you as you come down to Mitzrayim. And then Yaakov comes to the realization Yosef is alive, and he drops and he faints. And they awaken him and they bring him back too. And slowly, he comes to peace with the idea. And when he comes to peace with the idea, his spirit comes back to life. And this is a very, very powerful pasuk. Vatechi ruach Yaakov avihim. The spirit of Yaakov, their father, came back to life. And we find throughout the parsha that the question was asked over and over again, is my father still alive? Is my father still alive? When Yosef reveals himself to the brothers, the first thing he says is my father still alive? To Yosef, it's very important to know, is my father still alive? Yaakov represents their father. Guys, there's a very special role that a father plays in a person's life. And when it's Yaakov Avinu, so then it's a totally different deal, as we will see. When Yaakov's there, and now that his spirit comes back to life, they tell him, yes, Yaakov's alive. But the Torah tells us, no, Yaakov was not alive. When Sarah Imenu will pass, so we learned in Parshas Vayechi, in Chayei Sarah, what does it say? Vayiyu Chayei Sarah. And our sages say the numerical value of the word Vayiyu, Yud is 10, Vav is 6, Hey is 5, that's 21, Yud is another 10, 31, another Vav, 37. So our sages say she was 127 years old when she died. She had 37 years of life. Because at age 90, the Torah says she gave birth to Yitzchak, and until she had Yitzchak, she didn't feel like she was alive. To a parent, a child is part of their life. And so these 20 years that Yaakov is missing Yosef are 20 years where he's not alive. And Yaakov is devastated, and Chazal do not go against Yaakov for that. We have a halacha that says you're not allowed to mourn incessantly. The Talmud says there was a woman who mourned and she wouldn't stop mourning, and the rabbis came and told her, you know, there's the first day of mourning, and then the 3 days for crying, and then the 7 days for mourning, and then there's the 30 days, and there's a year, but then that's it, you have to move on with life. And the woman wouldn't stop crying, and they came to her again, and they said, you have to come to terms with it. She wouldn't stop crying. Until finally, the rabbis told her, you should know that when a person doesn't stop crying, they're crying for someone else. They're not only crying for the person who passed away. They're really crying for themselves. They're really saying, God wasn't fair. I'm a better person than God is, because I wouldn't have done what God just did to me. They're saying, I will not come to peace with what God did, and that's wrong. And she died. And that's a rule that's quoted in Halacha. When a person doesn't stop crying, so then the Halacha words it gently, the Halacha says they're really crying for someone else. So how come Yaakov Avinu could cry for 20 years, and our sages never say there was anything wrong with that, as far as I know? Because the Talmud says we have a rule. Hashem created the world in a way that if you act appropriately, then Hashem created the gift of forgetting. And if we do the acts the way we should, so then one of the gifts we have is that we can move on with life. We can forget. We don't have to spend every living moment connected to something that happened in our past. There are difficult things, right? But we can forget them. We can move on, and we have to forget them. But that's only if the person really died. And Yosef was still alive, and that's why Yaakov Avinu couldn't forget him. Because the gift of being able to forget someone is only when the person really passed. So Yaakov can't forget him. The parsha next week will begin with Vayechi Yaakov. Yaakov lived for 17 years, because his life was those 17 years, now that he was back with Yosef. And that's what we see here. Yaakov's spirit comes back to life. Chazal say his prophecy came back to him. All 20 years that he was sad, you can't have prophecy when you're sad. Inspiration comes through happiness, at least this type of heavenly inspiration. So Yaakov's spirit comes back to life. He again has Ruach HaKodesh. He again understands beyond what's seen by the naked eye. And now he understands the whole story. So Yaakov says, I have to go see Yosef. And he travels to Be'er Sheva, which is where his father was told, don't leave Israel. And his father stayed. And he's asking Hashem permission, am I allowed to go? And Hashem tells him, go. Now, really, what should have happened at this point is a group of pirates should have come and captured Yaakov and taken him down in shackles to Egypt. And just as Yosef was enslaved, the whole family should have been enslaved. but because of Yaakov's merits, that didn't happen. The truth is, the servitude in Egypt should have started in Yitzchak's days. Hashem told Avram, your children will be slaves in a foreign land. Why didn't it happen? Yitzchak prayed. Because Yitzchak prayed over it, it didn't come to fruition that way. And this is an important rule, that even when there's a decree from above, that only means that we have to pray, we have to work on it. It doesn't mean it's for sure going to happen that way. That was what we discussed last week. Yosef reads the interpretation of the dream. What does he tell Pharaoh? Buddy, you got to work. If God's telling you there's going to be a famine, that means you better prepare. It doesn't mean you should start weaving and say, oh no, we're all going to die. No, it means you better think about it and find the solution. Change your destiny. That's the greatness of Yosef. That's what we see with Yaakov. That's what we see with Avram. So Yitzchak prayed, and so he wasn't exiled. Yaakov is taken down. And Hashem tells him, don't worry, you will become a great nation in Egypt, and I'm going there with you. And this is a concept we have from here on, that Hashem says, wherever the Jewish people go, Hashem goes. Even though Hashem says, my land is Israel, and that's where I want to be, and that's where my focus is, but if my children are not here, I go with them. And that's the idea that Galita Shechinah Imahem, Hashem says, my presence will be found wherever you go. I'll be with you. And I'm taking you out as well. I'm going to bring you out. And that's why Anochi Alcha Gamalo, our sages say, when Hashem sent Moshe Rabbeinu to take the Jewish people out of Egypt, he said, Rebon Shom, you told my grandfather Yaakov, you're taking them out. Hashem tells Yaakov, here, I'm taking you, I'm going down with you, and I'm taking you out. So when Hashem told Moshe, go take them out of Egypt, Moshe says, I don't want to. Rebon Shom, you said you're taking them out, what are you sending me for? You said you're doing it. And that's what it says will happen in the days of the Mashiach also. That the Mashiach, the Jewish people, will say to their Ribbono Shel Olam, you said, Anochi, Anochi u'menachemchem, I'm the one that's going to comfort you. What are you sending us Mashiach for? Right? We want a direct connection with you. So, Yaakov starts heading down to Egypt. And he matches up all the kids. One of the keys to dealing with Galut is to be matched up. And here I'm going to say something that really should maybe be a little bit off the record. We have a rule. When we date, it's for marriage. Boys and girls grow up in modest ways, and when a boy and a girl are forging a relationship, it's for the intent of getting married. We don't date to have a girlfriend. And that's the way a Jewish home is supposed to look, and that's the way we bring up our kids, and that's the way Jewish life is supposed to look like. You're not supposed to grow up with girlfriends. You have your cousins. It's not like you never speak to a girl. You know what a girl is, right? But you have family events. It's not like, oh no, there's a girl. I can't look. I can't talk. I can't write. Okay, there's a certain normal interaction. You have sisters, and you see their friends, and whatever. You don't run away from home just because your sister brought a few friends over. And at the Shabbos table, you're going to see certain girls, and there's a healthy, normal way that a family grows. But basically, you're not developing girlfriends. You're going to date when it comes time to get married. And then a guy calls me and says, I live in Uzbekistan, or wherever, we'll make up a name, right? I made up Uzbekistan. I live somewhere where there aren't too many Jews. We don't have minyan for Shabbat. But I keep Torah, and I keep mitzvot, and my girlfriend keeps Torah, and she keeps mitzvot. And we're both in high school together, university together. We're lone souls out here in Chutz Laaretz. So what are you going to tell the guy? No, don't have a Jewish girlfriend. What's going to happen next? He'll have a non-Jewish girlfriend, right? You're going to tell him he's in a co-ed high school or a co-ed college. He's in a co-ed environment. So what are you going to say? No, you're not supposed to have a girlfriend, right? Wait until you're ready to get married. But I'm not. Rabbi, I'm 17. I can't get married now. I can't afford getting married. Where am I going to live? How am I going to build a family? I can't do that now. So now what are you going to tell him? You're going to say, no. You know, listen to my classes. I say, take off your former girlfriend, clean up your Facebook account. You should be faithful to your one and only, and that's it. You shouldn't have other girls in your life. And you build a relationship with one. That's true. But there are scenarios when a person is in exile where you can't ignore the reality that's surrounding a person. Yaakov Avinu, when the Jewish people are going into exile, Yaakov Avinu ensures that every boy is matched up with a girl. What's the deal with setting up a four-year-old and a four-year-old? What's going to happen out of that? So eventually they'll get married. Why was that so important? Because when you're surrounded by non-Jewish girls and people who don't know what modesty is, and they can innocently or not so innocently pull you away from everything you believe in, so then you have to ensure that everyone is spoken for. And the answer that you give a person when a person is sitting in a correct environment, building their life the way a person should, is not the same answer you give a person when they're in the middle of Egypt, when they're in a territory where the temptations are so great, you can't ignore reality. The guy, how's the guy going to fend for himself? You'll tell him, don't have a Jewish girlfriend, so then what's he going to have? And that's why when there's a saying that goes, NCSY is good for every guy who's not yet in NCSY. But once you're in, you should outgrow it, right? So when a person, if a person's reality is that that's the way they connect to Jewish people, so even though NCSY is co-ed, we say, great, at least you'll have a Jewish girlfriend. It's better than having a non-Jewish girlfriend. So go to NCSY and go to Jeff and you go to those functions, and the same thing with Bnei Akiva. You live in Israel, you're living in a good environment, so then your kids should be in a much better environment than that. Why would you send your kids to co-ed movement? Let them grow up with boys doing boys things, and when the time comes they'll build a marriage. But again, it depends on where a person's holding. When Yaakov Avinu goes to Mitzrayim, Yaakov Avinu says every boy has to have a girl that's going to be his wife. When a person is in Chutz Laaretz and a person is in all kinds of challenging environments, then a person has to realize it's a different scenario than living in a good environment. And that's why NCSY is so important. And that's why it's important to go to those events. And those who are planning on going to Chutz Laaretz and they're going to go to university there, you have to find out how many Jewish girls are in that university. Make sure your lab partner is a Jewish girl. Don't sit with someone else doing your lab homework, etc. You have to make sure you're surrounded, or at least you're with the people that Bezrat Hashem ultimately you're going to end up marrying. Obviously, you ask whether it's better to be there or not be there. You don't belong there. But the person isn't always asking that question. Sometimes the person tells you, reality is I'm there. Now what? So the answer is, go to NCSY. And I have a tragic story. About 14, 15 years ago, a kid I grew up with. I mean, he was in my younger brother's class, and he left the Jewish school. He went to public school. And then we tried to get him involved in NCSY, and I come from a community where the boys went to the boys' school, the girls went to the girls' school. My wife went to the same school I did, and I didn't know she existed, because she was in the girls' school, I was in the boys' school. Till we dated one another, I didn't know she even existed. I didn't know she, her family, totally separate, right, the boys' school and the girls' school. And this kid went to the same school as me, right, and then he left the school and went to public school. So he called and asked, should I go to NCSY? So I said, of course. But he wasn't so quick to go to NCSY. And to make a long story short, today he's married to a non-Jewish woman. His children are non-Jewish kids. And this is a kid that grew up in a very nice, kosher community. But he didn't end up there. And had he gone to NCSY, I believe the ending of the story would have been different. So Yaakov Avinu says, you're going to Chutz Laaretz. So Yaakov Avinu matches up all the kids. Make sure you have the partner you could build your life with. Ishu beito bao. Ishu beito, every person had their bai. There's an interesting point here. We know 20 years passed, right? We're going down to Egypt. Yosef was 17, and now we've had 20 years since Yosef was sold, right? Because he stood before Pharaoh when he was 30, the Pasuk says. So that means there were 13 years from his sale until he became king, and then 7 years of plenty and 2 years of famine. He tells the brothers, it's only been 2 years of famine, you have another 5 years to go. So 7 and 2, right? So it's been 20 years. It's been 22 years. Thank you. 22 years since Yosef was sold. It's been 22 years, corresponding to the 22 years Yaakov Avinu spent away from his parents. Yosef spent 22 years away from his parents. And the Pasuk identifies that in these 22 years, Yehuda had three sons, Er, Onan, Shelah. Then Er matures enough to have kids, gets married, and dies. Onan gets married and dies. Yehuda, Shelah becomes of marriageable age. Yehuda marries Tamar instead of Onan and has two children, Peretz and Zarach. And Peretz becomes of marriageable age and has two kids, Chetzron and Chamul. And all of this took place in 22 years. Now do the math. How does that happen? Right? Yehuda gets married, has three kids. And then the third one comes of marriageable age. Yehuda has children and grandchildren in 22 years. Do the math. So from here we see what the Talmud says in Tractate Sanhedrin, that in ancient times, the Talmud says, that people's nature was different, and at a very young age, people could impregnate and become pregnant. The Talmud says...
7-8.
Right, 7-8, yeah. Talmud says things were different back then. People were built differently. But that's, again, you see it from the verses. The Talmud proves it from other verses, and this, to my mind, is I would think it's an even better proof. I don't know why the Talmud doesn't bring this as the proof. Meaning this is, Yisachar has a son named Yov. Yisachar will discover that the name Yov is the name of a pagan idol, and he will change his name to Yeshuv. But here it's still Yov. He takes one of his shins from his name. That's why we pronounce it Yisachar, not Yisaschar. we move forward. Yaakov comes down to Egypt. It says 70 people coming down to Egypt. It wasn't really 70, it was 69. So Chazal say, the Talmud says, in fact, in the Jerusalem Talmud, that from here we see that the Torah rounds numbers. The number 70 doesn't have to mean 70. 70 could also be 69 or 68. Another interpretation is, it includes Yaakov. We have a euphemism. It says, those that came out of his thigh. They didn't come out of his thigh. But in Hebrew, we don't describe the male organ directly. Hebrew is called Lashon HaKodesh, the holy tongue. So there's no direct word for the organ of procreation. The male and female organ don't have a direct name. It's called the Aver, the organ. There's no word for it. In slang, in Hebrew, they gave it a name. But in real Hebrew, what? Okay, they gave it that too. But in real Hebrew, it doesn't really have a name. Hebrew is a holy language. When Chazal wanted to describe the female structure, so Chazal described it either as an alternate face or as rooms. The lower room, the upper room, the inner room. Chazal speak about, and Chazal don't call the canal. They don't have a special name for the female organ. They call it all her womb. The lower part of her womb, the upper part of her womb. When you read the Talmud, you try to understand what womb are we talking about. So Chazal didn't have a word for the canal that leads up to the womb. The Chazal just called it the lower part of the womb. Chazal say the womb has many rooms. It's like a building. So Chazal describe it as a hallway leading to etc. So all of this, so here we see that the Talmud says we try to talk cleanly. When we can get our point across without spelling it out. Here you see the Torah describes it as those that were emitted by Yaakov's thigh. And that's the same thing when King Saul goes to the bathroom. What does it say? It says, Lehasech et raglav, to pour out his feet. It doesn't say what he's really doing, right? That's why I remember when I was a kid, the first time I heard someone say the word diarrhea. I was like, why do you say that? Like in Hebrew, we don't talk that way. So in modern Hebrew, again, they gave it a slang. But in ancient Hebrew, you don't talk directly about feces, etc. Okay, yes, sir.
Okay, so the 69 and 66, then 69 and plus the 1. So there's people that say it's Yocheved. It's the 70th, right?
Mm-hmm.
I have a question. Including Yocheved, why is it not 71 with Osnat? We're excluding Yocheved. Why isn't it 70 with Osnat?
Osnat was in Egypt. What do you want?
So was Yosef, Ephraim, and Menashe. The pasuk says 66.
Right, but the pasuk is describing the descendants of Yaakov. Osnat is not described as a descendant of Yaakov.
She is.
If, according to the Midrash, that if I'm not mistaken, Tosfos asked that question, and I don't remember Tosfos's answer. There's a place that I think Tosfos asked that, maybe in Sotah.
He asked, why isn't she counted?
Yeah. He says, your question, the way you worded it, yeah.